Couple of introductory remarks first. My name is Len Pransky. I'm a general counsel to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I also practice almost exclusively in the area of nonprofit corporations, most of which, almost all of which, are religiously affiliated. So I have some deep working knowledge of religious organizations, the constitutional law that applies to them, and we do quite a bit of practice in the area of employment law, which is part of what I will be speaking of today. And the subject, of course, is homosexuality and the law. Please bear with me as I make my comments. I'm going to try to be as objective as possible, and certainly the legal principles and statutes and things that I am about to describe, I'm attempting to present objectively. I am a lifelong LCMS Lutheran. If my views in that regard on the gay rights issues sometimes reflect that, and there are those who are offended by that, I apologize in advance. I'm going to try hard not to do that. I will also use terms like homosexual and gay and lesbian interchangeably as it occurs to me, because it's simply easier that way, and I hope that, in turn, the use of the word gay sometimes offends some people, but I hope it does not. I intend to use it. No harm, no offense intended. I have two general subjects for this. The homosexual rights under the law and generally in our society have, of course, obtained a great deal of prominence in the press in the last, let us say, 8 years or so. They've always been an issue, but in recent years, the law is starting to come down in favor of homosexual or gay rights, whereas in past years, that wasn't the case. And there will be more and more of this as the gay rights movement presses their cause through the courts, and with the obvious goal in mind of obtaining legal rights that they genuinely want and feel that they need, and also because by gaining certain civil rights and legal status, their lifestyle and position in society gain legitimacy, and therefore I'm assuming they hope a certain cultural acceptability. And so that is what is driving and motivating much of this. But I'm going to focus principally, of course, on the achievement of a goal for gay people, for homosexuals, to have certain legal privileges under the law and legal rights under the law. And I intend to address that in two areas that have been the most prominent in recent years. And one is in employment law, that is, the laws which prohibit discrimination in employment. And the other is in the area of same-sex marriage, which, of course, is the hottest issue right now before many voters around the country, and especially this November. I will also blend into this the church's perspective and how churches may be affected by these legal changes that seem to be the trend, whether we want it to be that way or not. And so that's kind of the subject of my discussion and the perspective on it. I also encourage questions at any time. It may be helpful to the understanding of others in the room, too, if you ask for a clarification or have a question on a given point. So having said all of that, let me launch into this. The first category is the rights of homosexuals under the discrimination laws. And while most of what I will have to say in this area relates to the employment laws, it's understood that there are also efforts being made, and this is a legislative or political effort through lawmaking bodies, to carve out protected classifications, usually titled sexual orientation, in the employment laws, the housing laws, the public accommodation laws, and laws that prohibit discrimination in government-funded programs. Those are basically the current areas of discrimination laws, laws that prohibit discrimination for the usual reasons of which you are aware: age, sex, race, national origin, ethnicity, disability. Those are what we call protected classes or protected categories. What is going on now with the homosexual effort is to add to those protected classes sexual orientation, which would mean then that they achieve a special right under the law to be protected from any discrimination which is based upon sexual orientation. This, of course, is being sought not only to gain them employment rights and for other legal reasons, But they're also seeking the marriage law changes to allow them to marry and to enter into other forms of civil unions to acquire legal rights. That'll be the second part. The question is, in the employment area, for churches like the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that have a stated doctrinal position opposing the homosexual lifestyle, how will these legal changes affect them, both in the marriage area and in the especially employment discrimination area, maybe also in the public accommodation area? And I'll try to explain that. Question would become, for example, in the discrimination law area, what does a church that is opposed to a homosexual lifestyle do when an applicant for employee shows up who is clearly living an open gay lifestyle? Or one of the existing employees, it turns out, is openly displaying a homosexual or gay lifestyle or otherwise endorsing that lifestyle in a way that is contrary to the church's beliefs in that area. The question we will get as lawyers is, can the church fire that employee, or can the church turn that applicant for employment away because of its religious beliefs? And this usually arises simply because the appearance, the visibility of that employee in the workplace, depending upon his or her employment duties, is something that the church does not want displayed, because its employees, in a certain sense, represent what it believes. And therefore, it should have the right to say, no, this is a religious issue for us. And therefore, while you may feel that you're being discriminated against, it is what we have to do in order adequately to carry out our mission and practice our ministry to our people. And so that will be the question that will arise as this goes forward. Now, you might ask, well, where can this happen? Is there a law in place already that would permit this to happen? And not really, but I'll go through a little explanation of what is out there. And that is, you know, the question would be, if a church fires a homosexual employee, can he or she run off to the EEOC? And normally, as you know, if a person feels that he has been discriminated against and is in a protected class or category, such as race, sex, disability, age, that is where he would go. He would start his complaint process with a government agency, either state or federal, usually federal, because the federal law prohibits discrimination and employment in all of those areas, with the EEOC. The EEOC then would say, do we have jurisdiction of this or not? Is this a case that falls within our authority, and should we pursue it? Then they investigate it. They send a notice of the charge of discrimination to the employer. The employer is given time to respond, and then it goes forward from there. At the end of its investigation, the EEOC either makes a determination that there was discrimination or not, and then at that point, usually the case is turned back to the individual for enforcement. Sometimes the EEOC itself will enforce the law, seek damages, or seek reinstatement to employment, or whatever it might be. But that's the legal process. More normally, the person is told, you have a right to sue, and he or she is on their own to bring their suit. The EEOC will not take a sexual orientation discrimination claim, because under federal law, sexual orientation is not presently a protected class. And so there won't be any redress for a gay who feels that he has been discriminated against in employment through the EEOC, which enforces federal discrimination laws. In the federal law area, we may see some erosion of this, because there have been at least two cases in which the discrimination law, which gives rise to sexual harassment claims and creates legal standing for sexual harassment claims. There's the 64 Civil Rights Act, which prevents discrimination based upon sex, has been held to apply to the harassment of a female employee who dressed and acted in a masculine manner and who was therefore made fun of in the workplace and was able to carry the day on a sexual harassment complaint. Now, that's starting to get close to protection of sexual orientation under federal law. And that's an unfortunate case, because the statute itself doesn't sweep in sexual orientation. So what they were arguing was it falls under sex discrimination, Recently, there was a Sixth Circuit case which said the same thing for a male employee who apparently was just the opposite. It was he acted in a feminine and dressed in an effeminate manner. I don't think he was a cross-dresser, but he dressed in an effeminate manner. And the case was unfortunate in this regard because it said if the other case, which stands for the notion that a woman may dress like a man in the workplace and demand protection from sexual harassment, then the same is true of a man who dresses like a woman. Well, it won't be too long before that case is used as a precedent to defend a transvestite case. And so that's moving away from the traditional holdings under the federal employment law, which did not protect sexual orientation from discrimination, to protection of sexual orientation from discrimination in the workplace. So I'm not saying that's a trend, but the way the law works is that one case is decided, and it maybe takes a very narrow view, like this business of dressing like a man or acting like a man when you are a woman. And the next thing you know, that's bootstrapped up into a larger application. And from there, that one is bootstrapped up. The same kind of use of the case law in the courts is what culminated in Roe versus Wade in the abortion cases. That line of cases began with a Connecticut case that dealt with a law that prohibited contraception and the right of privacy theories that are embedded in the Roe versus Wade and are the basis of Roe versus Wade, the abortion case, began with those contraception cases and were used and cited to as the authority for where Roe versus Wade finally ended up. And so this same kind of what I call bootstrapping effect of the case law can occur and probably will occur in this sexual orientation employment discrimination area as well. So I just wanted to kind of give you that background. There are a couple of cases that the Supreme Court has decided that don't deal with employment but deal with homosexual rights. And the one case is the Colorado case in which the issue was whether a Colorado constitutional amendment to the state constitution, which prohibited municipalities and local governments in Colorado from passing discrimination laws that protected gay rights, was held to be unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. That kind of a case is troublesome because there's a lot of language in it pointing to the fact that that kind of discrimination, depriving a certain category of people of the protection of the law and the legal process, is unconstitutional, will be used in this bootstrapping effort as well. And in fact, I think it was in the second case that I'm referring to, and that was the Texas case, which held that an anti-sodomy law was unconstitutional and that a law that criminalizes sodomy is unconstitutional, which has a lot of language in it about the rights of gay individuals to engage in consensual sex and private conduct. So these are some of the trends that are emerging in the law. But then, okay, they can't go to the EEOC at this point. Maybe they will at some time in the future if the case law changes in that area. But then what about the states? You know, the federal law is one thing, but all the states have similar employment discrimination laws. Every one, I think, without exception, does, which usually include the usual categories that I have described: ethnicity, race, national origin, sex, disability, age. But in 15 states, sexual orientation has been legislatively enacted into the discrimination laws, the employment discrimination laws. And the only thing that is here very, very significant is that these laws probably would not have passed in the states where they were pressed politically, but for the fact that they contain exemptions for religious organizations, and all but one do, that one being Wisconsin. Most of these state laws which protect from discrimination gays and sexual orientation do exempt out religious organizations, churches, and also typically schools that are operated by churches. Minnesota, for example, has that. That many states have sexual orientation employment law discrimination.
Thank you, Dr. Branschke. My name is David Steckholz. I'm from San Francisco. And pastor of a church with a very large parochial school, Christian Day School. And I marvel at God's grace because we haven't had to face this issue yet, but I assume it will be coming at some point down the pike where a gay couple in San Francisco wants to enroll their child in our school. Do you have some counsel or advice on that? I've kind of thought in my own mind what I might do if that were to come up, but maybe you could speak to that.
In fact, I have a section of this presentation on that. Oh. If I could wait till I get to
that
point. I'd like
to
get through the employment law stuff first, because what you're talking about is a different category, but I do intend to address that because it is important to our schools. So getting back to this, there is only one state that has a blanket discrimination prohibition for sexual orientation without exception, and that's Wisconsin. And I don't know of any case that has attacked a church on an employment basis in that state. It's a little surprising. Turning to your point, sir, that there are many local ordinances, there are probably many, many local ordinances, I don't know how many, that prohibit discrimination in employment based on sexual orientation without religious employer exemptions. And I'm sure that that's what San Francisco has. It would surprise me if they would have found it politically necessary to include a religious employer exemption to get it passed in San Francisco. Then the question is, well, what does this mean to a church? What about my example when a gay applicant shows up to be a teacher in the school? Does that church in San Francisco have to hire that person? And the answer to that is no, because at this point we move the debate legally and the defense of the application of that ordinance legally into the realm of constitutional law and the First Amendment. And the First Amendment defense is quite simple, and that is, it permits churches and other religious organizations to freely exercise their religions. And so any law that attempts to take away a fundamental right, and there are certain enumerated rights in the Bill of Rights that are regarded as fundamental. Speech and religion are high on the list. Religion is probably the highest on the list. In order for that kind of a law to be applied in a church setting, where a church has a provable and demonstrated doctrinal position against a gay lifestyle, depending on the facts, of course, of what the position of employment is and so on, the state has a burden in that case of demonstrating that its interest in promoting this discrimination law somehow outweighs the fundamental right of free exercise of the church. The only interest that I can come up with that I can think of is that is just what it says, that they want gays to be protected as a protected class, and its interest is in not letting them be fired because of their sexual orientation. Well, the trouble with that is they can work elsewhere. The law applies to others as well. And so the quantitative impact of exempting churches from that requirement probably won't be seen as being an overwhelming, outbalancing factor when confronted with the fundamental right of the free exercise of religion. And this argument, of course, becomes more and more persuasive as the position of employment that has been denied to a gay gets closer to religious practice. And so that will be the defense. I know you asked me about what about an applicant to the school for enrollment? I'm going to get to that in a minute, but I think it's far more likely that you may see in San Francisco and other locations a claim of discrimination in employment, and probably the case would be picked based upon the fact that the position doesn't have any religious duties associated with it. So if the janitor is gay and you decide you can't have him around because everybody in your church is up in arms at his visibility and what that means to the children and what it means to the faith and practice of the church, that's the case that will be picked, probably, and as opposed to one where you turn away someone who is a teacher, who is a role model, who has to teach the religious teachings of the church to the students, and therefore his lifestyle and his homosexual activity would be directly inimical to what the church teaches as a matter of religious practice and belief. But I think the defense can be made and will be made soundly that these laws cannot be imposed upon churches for that reason. But it's going to have to be defended vigorously. It will come about. There will be cases because of these no exception ordinances like San Francisco's. And there are, I'm sure, a myriad of others as well. The problem with it, of course, is that it gets expensive because San Francisco probably has a human rights commission, and all the plaintiff has to do is go down there and file a complaint, and they take up the burden of the expense and can put the church to a great deal of legal expense and cost to defend. But I think you have to do it. It has to be done in order to preserve rights that relate to deeply held religious beliefs, which is where this stands. I mean, it's my impression, and I'm assuming all of you are LCMS, maybe not. I'm sure you're all aware that at every convention that I have been to, which began in 1992, there has been a resolution condemning homosexual conduct and activity. It's a very, very clear position of the Synod, and there hasn't been any movement away from that in all of these years. So that's the kind of thing that we simply have to defend. Now, getting back to this fine point that I tried to open a little bit, and that is, what if it is the janitor? The point there is that there is some pretty strong case law under the Constitution and at the Supreme Court level that says that the problem with San Francisco, for example, I'm sorry for picking on San Francisco, but that's the city that was mentioned, saying that, well, what's the big deal in terms of your religious belief and practice in the janitor being gay? Where is your religious free exercise in any way infringed by that? Well, as you all know, there may be legitimate reasons why. It could be that it doesn't matter to a church. The point is, should the church have the right to turn away anyone from an employment position based upon that? Now, the constitutional problem with an approach being taken, like trying to pick and choose between, you know, who is a religious worker and who is not a religious worker, is that it engages the state through its court system in making that determination. And the janitor is pretty clear cut, but not always. There are many other positions, like secretarial positions, that are mingled. And even the very act of the state court system or the federal court system engaging in evidence and taking evidence as to the duties and what is the religious nature of the duties of these different positions is regarded as forbidden by the Constitution, and the case law is pretty clear on that. This whole thing was at issue in the Civil Rights Act, where in connection with religious preference hiring, which churches are allowed to do, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits discrimination based upon religion. At first, the argument was made that that only protects religious workers, those who have to know the theology and practice and religious beliefs of the church to fulfill their duties as a qualification of their position. And so this same debate was argued in that area for years, and the circuit courts of appeal were holding in opposite ways. And finally, the Supreme Court got a hold of it in a case involving the Mormon Church, and said this, that first of all, the statute says what it says, that there's no exception to the religious preference in hiring. It can be at any level. The case involved, in fact, a custodian. But the second part of the reasoning of the court went off on this what we call entanglement issue, that the state, through its court system, cannot become entangled, or through its EEOC, cannot become entangled in making these determinations of what's religious and what isn't religious within the framework and governance structure of the church. It's none of their business under the Constitution, and that is a violation of the Establishment Clause, what is known as excessive entanglement in church affairs by the state. So those cases will come to bear on this refined issue of can these city ordinances be enforced against churches in non-religious worker cases. And I think, pretty sure I'm right on this, that based upon these prior precedents, it'll have to simply be a blanket exemption for any employment position at the church, because the courts will say you simply cannot get involved in making the determination of who is a religious worker and who is not a religious worker. Now, there's another aspect of this too, and that is the religious preference exemption in the discrimination laws. Churches, under the case I just described, which is the Amos case, are free to give preference to those of their own faith in hiring for any position. The way this probably and practically would resolve itself is to hire Lutheran Church Missouri Synod communicant members for positions, because there aren't too many practicing homosexuals who are Lutheran Church Missouri Synod members. The way to, if you want to call it, avoid the issue is to engage in that practice and say, no, this has nothing to do with homosexuality, even though it may. Our policy is that we prefer to hire Lutherans for all positions. And I'm saying that because that case law is well settled, that a church may, regardless of the nature of the position or the work to be performed, hire those persons of its own faith. And that is a pretty unshakable Supreme Court case. So that may be the practical end of this, that if you're in San Francisco and you want to avoid the problem, everybody on the staff should be an LCMS Lutheran. Let me mention something else that could be helpful, that we have already recommended to churches that have a doctrinal position against homosexuality, cohabitation outside of marriage, premarital or extramarital sex. And we get questions from time to time. Our secretary is living with a man outside of marriage, and it simply cannot be tolerated because it's so well known within the church. Or one of our teachers is pregnant, and she is not married, and it is causing a scandal in the church. Parents are threatening to remove their children from the school. We have to do something. And there, of course, are laws which prohibit discrimination based on marital status. There are laws which prohibit discrimination based on pregnancy. Now we're talking about the possibility that there will be laws based on discrimination based upon homosexual lifestyle or gay, sexual orientation. We encourage the use of what I call an employment morals policy, which, like any other employment policy, is put in place by whoever in the church does such things, whether it's a church council or a voters' assembly, along with other employment policies that they should have. It essentially says this: the congregation is a member congregation of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and as such has certain religious beliefs and practices on societal and moral issues. It is against the policy of this church to permit an employee to engage in any private conduct, whether on the work site, workplace, in the workplace, or not in the workplace, which is contradictory to those beliefs. And therefore, if you do that, it may be cause for dismissal from employment. And then it goes on to recite examples being abortion, cohabitation, premarital sex, a homosexual lifestyle. Now you say, well, what good is that? And frankly, from a pure legal perspective, if you're talking about a discrimination law, it doesn't do any good. But the reason that it is put, that we recommend putting it in place, and the reason for that is you can have as many policies as you want. If the law says you can't do it, you can't discharge a person. So the policy won't be a defense to the statute that would protect discrimination based on sexual orientation, or prohibit it, rather. But it would be helpful in two ways. First, on the contractual side, many states are employment contract states, meaning you have to have cause for termination of an employee. Missouri is an employment at will state where you don't. But we still recommend using it because it states the contract between the employee and the employer on that issue of private moral conduct. The second thing it does, in the same kind of a context, is that it creates an expectation for the employees. So that if, perhaps, if, for example, an employment applicant comes in and he is told, by the way, here is one of our policies relating to employment, he may say, well, forget it. I think I don't qualify and I don't want any trouble. I don't want to start this job and then find out I'm going to be fired because I'm actively living with another man and pursue a homosexual lifestyle. and it may deter a problem from arising. And then the third thing is that it is an expression of doctrine and religious belief. So it goes to prove the First Amendment defense that would be raised. And so that's why we have suggested that, we've distributed that policy to churches in the Synod and others as well, in other denominations, and we've encouraged the district presidents to make it available. Enough said about employment discrimination. I'm going to move to a different category, and it will sweep in your school issue. It's called public accommodation laws. As you are aware, the law generally prohibits discrimination in public accommodations based upon race and other categories. By public accommodation discrimination, this means that African Americans cannot be thrown out of a restaurant or refused service or a hotel space or some other thing like a retail establishment. And those are regarded as public accommodations. And as a result, that kind of discrimination has been banned, has been outlawed. And some of these local ordinances, and the one I'm going to describe to you is in Eugene, Oregon, have been extended to include public accommodation discrimination. They're not just employment discrimination, but public accommodation discrimination that protects, as a separate class, sexual orientation. Now, getting to your question, can a parochial school turn away a gay couple that wants to enroll a child? The answer normally would be yes, because a parochial school is a private school. It's not a public school. Therefore, the starting point is, as a private school, you can make your own rules as to who you admit and who you do not admit. And a good example of that is most parochial schools give admission preference. Not all of them do, but most of them give admission preference to the children of their own membership. So there's immediately a religious discrimination going on, a lawful religious discrimination. And the reason it's lawful is because it's a private school. And so it doesn't have to open its doors to just everybody if it chooses not to. Now, the question has arisen in Eugene, Oregon, where one of these ordinances exists, where the parochial school, and this was a Roman Catholic school, turned away a gay couple that wanted to enroll their child. And they have been sued now under the public accommodations law by the gay couple, saying that it violates the public accommodations prohibition on discrimination based on sexual orientation. So the issue will be, is that parochial school a public accommodation or not? And we think not, and I'm sure that's what the Catholic Church thinks, and we'll be defending on that basis. We are watching that case very carefully to see what the outcome of that will be. And you may say, well, who cares? You know, what is the objection? Well, we had an example of our own in one of the Missouri Synod districts where it was bitterly debated in the Voters' Assembly of the Church when they had a gay couple apply, because there were those who felt that this was an opportunity to evangelize, to reach out, to proclaim the position of the church. And it was the child who would suffer. And why not help the child? Why not admit the child, telling the parents, understand, we're going to teach your child that your particular lifestyle is wrong and is immoral, and see what happens. Then there were those who said, and I think principally it was the administration of the school, yeah, but what about the practical side of this? I mean, we're going to have this gay couple showing up at school functions for parents, just like every other parent. We're going to have them coming into the school, picking up their child and dropping their child off. We're going to have them visible in our premises. And what does that say to our membership? What does it say to anybody who is coming here because of what we espouse as religious belief? It kind of contradicts what our mission is, what our purpose in being there is, to allow that image to exist and have to explain it away. So that is what the objection of the Catholic school in Eugene, Oregon was as well. In the case I mentioned, there was no public accommodation law and there was no lawsuit and there was anger, but there wasn't any legal action taken. But that is exactly what the concern of the Catholic school in Eugene, Oregon was, and we're just going to have to see what happens with that case. And of course, here again, First Amendment law will come to bear, that free exercise of religion is implicated even in the parentage of the children for the reasons that I just gave. Yes, sir?
Yes, my name is Tom Fisher, and I'm a student here. And I guess the question I have, if the case that we accept that child and the parent says, well, that's fine, but we don't want our child involved in any of the programs that might relate to teaching about your views on proper marital orientation and such, are we obliged to obey those requests by the parent? In other words, take them out of chapel and take them out of certain programs?
I see your point, and I don't think that can happen, because that would clearly say that now the law is being applied in such a way, if that were enforceable under this public accommodation law, that the courts would say, you have to take this child and you have to agree not to teach it your beliefs, is a direct prohibition on the practice of a belief. And that is such a clear-cut violation of the Free Exercise Clause that I can't imagine that outcome. I can only think that maybe there would be some court somewhere would say you have to take the child, but not that you can't teach it your beliefs, because that is your religious mission and part of the exercise of your religion. Yes, sir.
Thank you for addressing that question. I would have taken that approach that you had suggested as the first approach of allowing that child to be enrolled in the school, but to make it perfectly clear to the parents what we believe, teach, and confess, what the child would be taught, and that the child would, in all instances, be fully a part of the religion classes and all other classes, including school chapel. Assuming that that happened, you've now established a precedent. What if you later on wanted to go against that precedent because all of a sudden you had quite a number of people challenging or applying for admission, and then the congregation? Or what I'm just trying to envision here is if our largely Asian school and our parents said, wait a minute, this is changing the nature of this school, and we're out of here. We don't want to be a part of this. Now you've changed something here. So then the church reverses its admission policy and puts something in place that does that. If you have changed precedent from that precedent, are you then opening yourself up for some legal ramifications?
Well, yes, I think so. A couple of comments on that. I think before you were to do it, you would want to do as the congregation did that I was referring to in the Synod, and that is sound it out with the people and find out whether they want that to be a part of the mission of the church or not. The other part, the problem with doing it and then undoing it, is that you lose some persuasiveness on your First Amendment defense if later you decide not to admit these people and they sue under the statute. And your defense is that, no, we can't have this because it violates the free exercise of our religion by having this image in our school. Because then it gets thrown back at you, well, why wasn't it a violation? You know, why could you freely exercise your religion before but not now? And so there is that danger. And the outcome of the situation to which I was referring was that we created a school policy that related to this area in which the school simply reserved the right at any time either to refuse or to expel after admission any person whose family engages in private immoral conduct under the beliefs of the church. And that at least would give you something on that, and it was based upon really the notion that, well, maybe there are some schools like yours that want to do this as a part of what they feel is a genuine good opportunity to evangelize. But that, what if the worst happened and this turned into a big mess, and that the parents in the school, the members of the church, did not foresee the disruptive effect that the gay couple would have in allowing their child to come to the school, sporting event, whatever it might be, where it just simply wasn't tolerated. And so this policy attempts to do that. Now, that was given to the school's elementary schools department of the Board for Congregational Services. And if you want to see that, you can look at it. And it occurs to me now that you say this that maybe it could be strengthened to include provisions which would more easily permit extraction from the situation if you start it and then want to stop it. So that policy, once again, is helpful. We think it would overcome any contractual issue that could be raised if you ask a couple of parents to take their child out of the school because of their conduct. And this could be in other areas as well. It could be the other areas that I described, abortion, cohabitation, other kinds of adultery, other kinds of known immoral conduct that simply have become impossibly disruptive for the school. That is something that probably should be examined in a location such as San Francisco, where this is more likely to happen. I'm going to leave this subject now and talk about same-sex marriage, so if there are any more questions on this discrimination area, we'll take them now. And I probably haven't allowed enough time for this, and this next thing, and this gets a little dry, because what I'm trying to do here with this legalization of marriage for same-sex couples is to bring some semblance of understanding to this myriad of actions that have been taken lately, and I'll indicate what I'm talking about there in a minute that most of you are aware of. But why is this thing being pressed? Well, the answer is that gay couples, homosexual couples of both sex, are seeking to obtain just an enormous number of legal rights involving money, even, that arise when they can say that they are married. And, you know, just to give you a few, and that one writer estimated that there were probably over 1,000 benefits under federal laws and regulations that attend marital rights and privileges. And so that is probably the initial reason why, because they want to have access to these same things. And the other is probably, well, we feel that we are married in our way of thinking, in our lifestyle. And so why can't we be married just like a heterosexual couple is? And some of these rights would be, just for example, the property rights of a surviving spouse when one spouse dies. Almost all states have laws which assure a surviving spouse of a certain share of the property of the deceased spouse. Rights with respect to children. Gay couples are able to adopt children in certain states, and maybe even in most states. I know it's true in California. Federal and state tax benefits, joint return rates. There can be welfare privileges that attend being a spouse. There can be death benefits under Social Security and other programs. And then pension plans typically will create. I think even the church's own Concordia plans create spousal rights for surviving spouses in the benefits that were payable to the church worker. So those are just a few of the reasons why this is, that the gay movement is pressing hard to obtain the privilege of being able to say that we are legally married under the law for all of these purposes. In addition, as with the other area of law that I discussed, the right to marry, I think, would be regarded by gay couples as a major step toward social acceptability of their lifestyle. And so I think that's a part of what is driving the agenda, the principal one being legal, the second being societal. The result of these efforts, which kind of began in the mid-90s in prominence, has been a whole bunch of activity. There have been court actions in Hawaii, Vermont, the most recent and notorious Massachusetts. California has addressed it in the context of the San Francisco illegal marriage issue. In reaction to that, there were statutes passed in 38 states banning same-sex marriage, basically saying what most of them say, and that is marriage is recognized only if it is between one man and one woman. That's the typical language. But 38 states, the voters are seemingly overwhelmingly against same-sex marriage, yet the court system is driving it based upon constitutional principles. There is a statute now for the first time in one state, it's Massachusetts, which actually permits marriage between same-sex couples. I think it's the only statute that has that. There are a state that has that. There are other states that have civil union statutes which grant limited rights of what would be marital rights to couples of the same sex, and civil ceremony statutes in other states. I think Vermont falls into this category. Hawaii falls into this category. And then the most recent thing, and the thing you're going to see on your ballot in many states, and I do have that list, here in Missouri, it was on the ballot in the primary in August. Nobody thought the turnout would be sufficient to vote on it, but it's a state constitutional amendment saying the same thing, that marriage is acknowledged only if it is between one woman and one man and not members of the opposite sex. But there's about 20 of them that are coming up. On November 2, I've got Arkansas, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Michigan, Missouri already did it by a 70% majority vote, which is an overwhelming majority. Mississippi, Montana, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, and Utah all have state constitutional amendments on the November ballots to ban same-sex marriage under their constitutions. And then now there's a federal law, too, that says that marital rights of spouses of the same sex under federal law won't be acknowledged. It goes on to say that no state needs to recognize the gay marriage laws of another state. That's called DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. You've probably read about that. And now, of course, President Bush is supporting a federal constitutional amendment which does the same thing. So you kind of feel like, even lawyers feel like, well, why all this different law? What is the point of having so much of it, and what is its purpose, and how does it all fit together? I'm going to try to do this briefly, and I think what I will do, because I'm going to run out of time, is flip-flop this in the next session so that I take this issue first. For those of you who want to hear the end of the story on this business of same-sex marriage. This all started in the 90s with a case in Hawaii which focused on, does a gay couple have a constitutional right to be married? And that case went in that direction, saying yes. And so the outcome in Hawaii was they adopted a civil ceremony statute which permits gays to form a civil union, but it also adopted a constitutional amendment which prohibits gay marriage. So in other words, civil union, yes, marriage, no. You say, well, what on what basis, suddenly after, 200 years of our country's existence, is this constitutional right based? I mean, what is the reasoning? And the reasoning is a lot simpler than you think. It's actually a no-brainer. Every state constitution, as the U.S. Constitution, has an equal protection and due process clause. And simply stated, the reason is that, the clause in the federal 14th Amendment is that no state shall deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Well, the answer is simple. If the law permits only heterosexual couples to marry, gay couples are denied equal protection, and that's why it's unconstitutional. Now, I only read carefully the Massachusetts court case. What could have been done with this case is the Massachusetts court could have said, yes, but equal protection analysis is this. If there's no fundamental right involved that is being infringed, then the law must simply have some rational basis to pass constitutional muster. They held that there was no rational basis at all for the law prohibiting same-sex marriage and being available only to heterosexual couples. And my feeling on that was, why? Why did they have to go in that direction? It could have been argued that the rational basis is simple. It's that heterosexual marriage is a fundamental building block of Western civilization and society and has been for 4,000 years. And therefore, that is the rational basis for the disparity and for the unequal protection of the laws. But instead, they brushed it. They didn't even consider that. They didn't brush it aside. They simply said, we can't see any. And the state didn't argue that very well in its opposing argument. So the Massachusetts Supreme Court, and I'm sure this is why Hawaii did it and why Vermont did it, declared the application of those laws to only heterosexual couples to be unconstitutional. And then, that's why now we're seeing the counterpunches that are being brought forward by the family values side of this debate. And that is the state constitutional amendments. The Massachusetts, Vermont, and Hawaii cases were all based upon state constitutional provisions. Constitution is amended to declare that same-sex marriage is not allowed. Then that's the end of that case and the end of that debate. So that is why you see 20 states on the ballot with these amendments in November. It's to counteract state constitutional challenges to same-sex marriage prohibitions. Then the next attack and situation, which again is a punch and a counterpunch, and that is this problem. The Hawaii case sent everybody scurrying about because of the full faith and credit clause of the United States Constitution. The full faith and credit clause of the Constitution simply says, full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state, and the Congress may, by general laws, prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved. This means that if a gay couple marries in Massachusetts and moves to Missouri, Missouri, despite all of its laws, must recognize the validity of that marriage. Now then, the Congress steps in as a counterpunch and enacts the Defense of Marriage Act, which basically says we're acting under the second sentence of this clause, which says the Congress may, by general laws, prescribe the manner in which such acts shall be proved and the effect thereof, and saying we're declaring these same-sex marriages to be of no effect in other states under our privilege in that section of the full faith and credit clause. Is it going to work? It's being already tried in Florida, where a couple from Massachusetts moved, or Vermont, I'm not sure which, moved to Florida, and is challenging Florida's prohibition on same-sex marriage under this provision of the constitutional law. And since I'm drawing to a close, and I do have a lot more material, but I'm going to briefly just jump to the end, and that is this federal amendment is now being sought as a final counterpunch to the full faith and credit clause argument, the purpose being to say that no state will have its constitution or the Constitution of the United States construed to require recognition of same-sex marriage. It's not worded exactly like that. I have the exact wording here. The point of that is to block out the requirement of the full faith and credit clause that a state which has banned same-sex marriage must acknowledge and recognize the same-sex marriage of a couple that was married validly and legitimately under the law of another state like Massachusetts. And so the final story on this, the final outcome of this issue will be that if the federal amendment is passed, it will end the debate. If the federal amendment is not passed, there will be ongoing litigation until every state's law is beaten down either under the U.S. Constitution or under a state, even with state constitutional provisions, the federal constitution can be argued to trump the state constitutional amendments, and they may be of no effect as well. If you ask me where is this going, it's going down the path that if the federal amendment to the Constitution is not passed, we will see same-sex marriage eventually, if not in our lifetimes, then in the next, probably being required to be recognized in every jurisdiction in the United States. Thank you very much.